Andreas Klumper will tell us about integrable systems, solved and open problems in condensed matter physics.
Okay, thank you very much, Chairman. I'm grateful to Niklas, not only for tolerating me at this nice conference, but even giving me the possibility to speak to you. The topics I would like to touch in my talk are certain condensed matter physics problems, and I would like to show to you two, let me say, solved problems and two open problems. And everything I'm going to show to you is related just to the spin 1/2 Heisenberg spin chain. I could or would like to talk to you about the supersymmetric TJ model, Hubbard model, and other models, but I think the time of 45 minutes or so is just not enough. And there are many, many interesting problems related to the spin 1/2 Heisenberg spin chain, such as, normal thermodynamical properties like magnetic susceptibilities, the low temperature properties of this, the thermal transport properties, spin transport. Well, the magnetic susceptibility and thermal transport can be viewed as solved. The spin transport is an open problem. The spin Drude weight at zero frequency and finite temperature is really difficult to calculate, and this is an absolutely open problem. The question is this spin Drude weight at finite temperature zero or non-zero? In the course of my talk, I would like to introduce or remind you of a couple of methods to calculate the thermodynamics of integrable systems, and there are three different but equivalent sets of nonlinear integral equations. I think everybody here has heard about Y system, the terminology then is less unique. I would like to call it the A system. Anyway, so this leads to a finite set of nonlinear integral equations, absolutely equivalent to the Y system, and there is an interpolation which is possible. And then there is a method number three. I would like to call it the single T system. Just one integral, nonlinear integral equation for the transfer matrix. And, that's, so to say, the last or the most, the latest achievement by Minoru Takahashi. Unfortunately, this T system or this particular nonlinear integral equation is difficult to use in practical life. And at the end of my talk, I would like to talk about correlation functions of the spin 1/2 Heisenberg spin chain. There are results for the spin 1 chain, but, not today. These results are based on the factorization of the equal time correlators. This is just about equal time correlators. No dynamical correlation functions right now. But these results apply to and can be made very specific and explicit for the case of the thermodynamic limit and arbitrary finite temperature, or for zero temperature and arbitrary system size L. Okay, so these are my collaborators of the most recent projects, and the other ones will be named in the course of the talk. So the spin 1/2 Heisenberg chain is known. Here's the Hamiltonian for a system with L sides. Mostly I will impose periodic boundary conditions. So there's XX, YY exchange of just nearest neighbors, and there is ZZ exchange of possibly different strengths. And this anisotropy parameter delta can be set to arbitrary real numbers, and when moving from minus infinity to plus infinity and looking at the ground state properties, you discover three different phases. There's a critical phase for delta between minus 1 and plus 1. Maybe I should say from minus 1 exclusively up to 1 inclusively, etc. Don't let us skip these fine points. For delta less than minus 1, we have a gap phase, but it's a ferromagnetic phase, completely frozen. Not so interesting in principle, at least in the ground state. But at finite temperatures, it's different. And for delta larger than plus 1, we're in the gapped anti-ferromagnetic phase. Sometimes this model, the spin model, is written in terms of fermions. This is a lattice particle formulation with spinless fermions, C and C dagger. And the interaction here is a density-density interaction at nearest neighbor sites. Okay, so this sets the problem. And let us look at the isotropic interferromagnetic spin-1/2 chain first. There are some experimental realizations, at least in, well, a few years ago, strontium copper oxide was traded as a very good realization. And so on the right side, in this figure, you see experimental data for this compound. What is shown? It's a zero field susceptibility in, well, dots or circles versus temperature. The zero field susceptibility is the second derivative of the free energy with respect to magnetic field. And these are the experimental data. And there are a few. So point is a little bit weak. So there are two or three attempts to fit these experimental points with theoretical data. Very old data are due to Bonner and Fischer. They diagonalized short chains and then calculated the thermodynamical properties. And of course, nobody tells you, or no experiment directly tells you about the exchange coefficient that I dropped in front of this Hamiltonian. So that has to be fitted somehow. But whatever you use, which exchange coefficient 2,800 Kelvin or 2,200 Kelvin, the Bonner-Fischer curve is no good. And there is a curve number 3 completely hidden by these symbols, and that's a much better fit. This was the first proper low-temperature treatment of the spin-1/2 Heisenberg chain by more or less analytical means due to Eggert, Affleck, and Takahashi. And here in the inset, here, some kind of linear log plot is shown. And, well, eventually at very low temperatures, the experimental data deviate from the theory. Now, look at the left side. Here in the inset, you see the susceptibility from very low temperatures up to very high temperatures. And there you see, and these are really reliable data. These data have been obtained by solving the nonlinear integral equations I just mentioned, and the accuracy of these data is, I think, almost 10 digits. Anyway, so here in the main panel, you see the very low temperature behavior of the susceptibility versus temperature, and you see a infinite slope at zero temperature. It's the susceptibility drops with an infinite slope to a finite zero temperature value. Okay, so this is quite singular, but that is completely captured by the nonlinear integral equations, and when taking these results by the nonlinear integral equation and comparing to a field theory or, let's say, conformal perturbation theory, well, the agreement is really excellent. Okay, the next problem one could be interested in are transport properties, and of particular interest are is thermal conductivity. People are interested in finding materials that are electrical insulators but are good thermal conductors, just for technological reasons. And here are shown the plots of the thermal conductivity relating heat current with temperature gradient for two compounds. So here is shown the conductivity versus temperature. And you see three sets of curves, colored curves. The systems have one-dimensional substructures, magnetic substructures, and then the system behaves anisotropic, or in space direction. So the red curve, in both cases, refers to the heat conductivity along the chain length in these or ladder directions in these compounds, and the blue lines refer to the heat conductivity perpendicular to the, let's say, main axis. There are usually two contributions to these heat conductivities of, let's say, crystals in general. Here at low temperatures, on the left and on the right, there is a maximum visible. This is due to the phonons, the lattice vibrations. They carry heat if the temperature is not too low and not too high. Usually, there's a much larger contribution due to electrons, to conduction electrons. Here there are no conduction electrons. But still there is a large additional contribution to the heat conductivity, and this is due to the magnetic excitations of the system. So these are some results, two materials, and why are magnetic systems so successful in transporting heat? Well, according to textbook knowledge, these conductivities are given by Kubo theory, and this involves dynamical two-point correlators, of the involved currents. Here it's the energy current, and we need to calculate the current expectation value of the unperturbed system, so without any temperature gradient. But then we take an integral over time, real part and the imaginary part, and it's a kind of Fourier transform, and this gives us the dynamical conductivity. Now, for the spin 1/2 Heisenberg chain, which is not really realized in this compound, but I think here it's major, more or less a spin ladder, but anyway, for a spin 1/2 Heisenberg chain, this integral can be done easily, because the energy current for the spin one half Heisenberg chain is conserved. So it means it commutes with the Hamiltonian. And since we have this commutation, there is no time dependence of this operator, of the current operator. So it completely drops out. The integrand is just a constant, and then the result is given here. And the real part is nothing but a delta peak with maximum at zero frequency times a prefactor. And the prefactor, this prefactor is called the my fingers are too big. Sorry. So this prefactor, that's called the Drude weight, and it's given by inverse temperature squared times the expectation value of the energy current squared. And just because this energy current is conserved, this object, this expectation value can be calculated within the thermodynamical framework by just introducing suitable Lagrange parameters into the free energy. And that's what we did. The result with Kazumitsu Sakai already a couple of years ago is shown here for the, so the solid line is the thermal Drude weight for the isotropic chain. The lowest line is the thermal Drude weight for the free fermion case, and then the interpolating curves. So you see the thermal Drude weight is non-zero for non-zero temperatures, and it drops by, in 1 over T or 1 over T square manner to zero at high temperatures. Why is the energy current conserved? Well, the energy current is defined from the continuity equation. So we take the local Hamiltonian or local interaction, and its time derivative is written in terms of a divergence of some other object. And on the lattice, this equation has to be, the object on the right-hand side has to be replaced by a difference term, and that equation then is satisfied with this ansatz. So the current, the local energy current of the spin 1/2 Heisenberg chain is just given by the commutator of, so to say, nearest neighbor exchange terms, or the local interactions on the left bond and on the right bond. This was known for a long time, but the calculation were done only in 2002. Okay, why is it conserved, and what does conservation mean? The total sum over these terms for all k commute with a Hamiltonian. That's non-trivial, but it can be checked. So, I mean, the total energy is conserved, that's clear. And the local condition for the energy conservation is written here. But the, it's not clear from this construction that the sum over all jk for k from 0 to L or something like that commutes with the Hamiltonian, but that can be checked. Okay, so this is a conserved current, and it's one of the currents appearing in the list of conserved quantities of the spin 1/2 Heisenberg chain. Actually, it's the second logarithmic derivative of the transfer matrix, and we can deal with that. So what is the usual technique to calculate the free energy or partition function? All of you know it, but I have to go through these steps for completeness. It's a thermodynamical beta ansatz going back to Yang and Yang. Yang and Yang showed how to calculate the partition function or free energy of a particle system with one type of particles and diagonal scattering. It's a rather combinatorial approach. Godin and Takahashi extended that approach to systems with more than one species of particle, with several species of particle with diagonal scattering. And interestingly, in the spin 1/2 Heisenberg chain, we have to deal with infinitely many of such particles, namely the magnon and the bound states of the magnons. Two magnons form a bound state, three magnons, and so on and so on. And therefore, we have an infinite number of these particle species, and therefore, we have an infinite number of some, well, auxiliary functions we nowadays call y. So there's y sub j with j equal to 1, 2, 3, and so on. And these functions have to satisfy this set of nonlinear integral equations. Log of y1 is related to log of 1 plus y2, and y2 is related to log of 1 plus y1. That would be okay, but then there's also log of 1 plus y3, and so on. So an infinite hierarchy. It doesn't stop. What are the symbols? S star means convolution of the 1 over cosh function with what follows. The first term here is a driving term. Beta is a reciprocal temperature. The magnetic field enters, as a kind of asymptotic conditions for log of y sub j, for j to infinity, and that defines the problem. Once you have solved these infinitely many equations, you take the first function y sub 1, discard all the rest, you insert y sub 1 into this expression to get the free energy. So this is not so economical, of course, here. Yeah? You don't want to solve for infinitely many equations and then discard most of them. Anyway, it's a correct and, in principle, manageable formulation. From such a formulation, Zamolodchikov in 1990 obtains a so-called Y system. That's, so to say, the integral equations written in terms of functional equations. Of course, going from the integral equations to the functional equations is unique, but going back is not so unique. Paul Pierce and I in 1992 managed to, completely ignoring about the TBA and so on, we managed to get from a T system, that means a fusion hierarchy of transfer matrices, we managed to extract the Y system and from that to derive TBA equations. And we were quite proud of that because within this procedure, it is clear how to deal with other solutions, let's say with excitations. Only in this approach, you really know what you do when looking for, let's say, other solutions of modified TBA equations. Anyway, let me call this the Y system or TBA or thermodynamics number one. Thermodynamics number two, or maybe A system, consists of, I'm still talking about the same problem, spin 1/2 Heisenberg chain. Actually, it's an interferomagnetic isotopic point. So this involves just two functions, A and A bar. In a certain sense, A bar is a complex conjugate, if H was just imaginary, but okay. So here, a similar structure appears, log of A, log of 1 plus A on the right-hand side, convolution integrals, and so on. There are driving terms. The driving term here that consists of something like an energy, bare or dressed energy of spinons, and the magnetic field appears explicitly. There's no asymptotic condition. I mean, there's no infinity. So you, something like before, log of y sub j divided by j approaches a certain limit. That doesn't exist here. Here, the magnetic field appears explicitly. Okay, you solve it. The functions you use are written down here, 1 over cosh. This integral can be reformulated in terms of the digamma function if you wanted. Anyway, you take the solutions, A and A bar, insert into this expression, you get the free energy. Fine. Something like that was done for thermodynamics, or even before, for finite size and zero temperature properties by us, and in case of literal thermodynamics by me and this one, De Vega. Junji Suzuki showed how to interpolate between this formulation with the two functions and the Y functions. And Hegedish applied that to this interpolation formulation to RSS-like models. There are many, many other and related results with respect to SL 3, 4, 5 models. We understand how to deal with those, so I'm not going into any details here. But I just would like to point out that the general SLN case is not yet well understood, but maybe by the work of those people here, and based on the background transformation of the T system, it will be possible, I expect. Okay, what is thermodynamics number 3? Thermodynamics number 3 is shown here. The free energy is given by the logarithm of the largest eigenvalue of the transfer matrix at spectral parameter 0. And the largest eigenvalue, so T of V is just a function, has to satisfy this nonlinear integral equation. And unlike before, no logs of, let's say, function and log of 1 plus function are involved, but T and 1 over T. And the temperature is hidden in the B function, which are given here, and the magnetic field appears there. This is probably the nicest formula, but it takes a lot of effort to extract useful results from that. And Zengo Tsuboi has such results and generalizations for higher rank systems. So with respect to this formulation, higher rank is not such a problem. I mean, but it has been done by Zengo. Okay, what are generalizations? If you replace the driving term beta times energy by something like system size times momentum, then you deal with finite size and zero temperature. So in a sense, from model you go to the mirror model, or from the mirror model to the model. I'm not so sure about the terminology. Excited states can be obtained by deformation of the contours or by pulling straight these contours and having to deal with additional driving terms on the right-hand sides of these TVA-like equations. Also, analytic continuation with respect to, let's say, boundary fields or twists is possible, and there are many results on the tricritical hard squares and critical hard hexagons, general RSS lattice models. Actually, for the spin 1/2 Heisenberg chain, we managed to obtain the full conformal spectrum by the dye logarithmic trick and with deformed contours. Well, the deformed contours are quite nice because they keep the algebraic structure of this nonlinear integral equation. And once you know how to extract the finite size corrections to the ground state energy, you can extract all finite size 1 over L corrections to all excitations. And what you have to deal with is a dilogarithmic integral with, well, on non-standard contours, so to say. You deal with different branches of the dilogarithm. Okay, and then later, many people, in particular here in the audience, have dealt with similar questions. Dorian Tatier, I think they looked at analytic continuation of TBA equations in the scaling limit of the equations I showed you before. Work on the Sine-Gordon models is here. There are some interesting phenomena everywhere, but of course I know the phenomena in the spin 1/2 Heisenberg chain much better, so I would like to comment a little bit. Here we have looked at the critical phase, but closer to the ferromagnetic point. And there it appears that temperature-dependent spatial oscillations, incommensurate oscillations, without magnetic fields appear. And so on. So, okay, here I think everybody in the audience can comment on these papers much better than I can do. So let me go to the open problem. So what I showed before, susceptibility, specific heat. I didn't show these results, but these are the standard quantities, but also the expectation value of conserved currents. That can be obtained just from free energies. The spin current is more complicated. What is the spin current? The spin current is a current which satisfies a continuity equation with a spin, local spin variable. The on the lattice, the spin current is given by this. This is not really surprising. It's just hopping from right to left, minus hopping from the left to the right, or something like that, of the spin pointing up. And anyway, so that's the normal expression you would have expected. So the total spin is conserved, but the spin current, the total spin current, is not conserved. So the sum over these terms does not commute with the Hamiltonian. The sum over all local SZ observables, that commutes with H, but not this current. And therefore, the reasoning I showed before does not apply. So in this case, the Drude weight, if it should appear at all, I mean, it's not given by the expectation value of J squared. But we can relate the Drude weight to energy level curvatures with respect to twisted boundaries. So it's the Drude weight is given by the spin stiffness of the microscopic energy levels. Unfortunately, for finite temperature, we have to perform an average of this quantity. For zero temperature, it's simple, and it's simply given by the spin stiffness of the ground state, and this result is known and since a long time. For finite temperature, it's complicated. And at finite temperature, there was an attempt by Fujimoto Kawakami 98 and carried out by Zotos for the XXZ chain. And that's a generalization of the traditional TBA. The TBA is generalized, and it's based on magnets in the bound states, as I said. And the scattering of these particles and so on. Now, for calculating the spin stiffness of the microstates compatible with a macrostate, you have to calculate finite size corrections. But then you have to deal with and have to work with certain problems. The bound magnon states are usually described by ideal strings in TBA. Otherwise, it's impossible to do that. So this is the source of a problem, and it's probably fatal for calculating finite size corrections. Another problem is that the distribution of the bound states, I mean the distribution of magnons and two strings, three strings, which is usually modeled by continuous density functions, is not appropriate for finite size calculation. Anyway, if you ignore the problems and just go ahead, then you get these results. Here's shown the Drude weight, the Drude weight, or the estimate of the Drude weight, is a function of temperature for various anisotropies. Here the upper curve is for delta equals zero, and this is for delta equals 0.9, whereas delta equal 1, delta equal 1 is just the horizontal line, 0. 0 for finite temperature and non-zero for zero temperature. So anyway, that's the result by Zotos for the isotropic interferromagnetic Heisenberg chain. The Drude weight for finite temperature is 0. Okay. Then there were other people like Alvarez and Gross. They did quantum Monte Carlo calculations, not exactly for the isotropic point, but they took, this is mu equals 6. What is mu equals 6? That corresponds to delta, the anisotropy, equal cosine of pi over 6. So it's something like 0.9. Anyway, close to 1. They did quantum Monte Carlo calculations, and as a function of temperature, they got Drude weight shown here. star, no temperature variation. And they were puzzled by this. They expected behavior according to the results by Zotos is shown here by a dashed line, but the numerical results deviate. So they were a little bit puzzled. These guys were puzzled, and then they talked to us, and we had done already in 2001 some calculations on a completely different basis, so to say, well, it was a generalization of thermodynamics number 2. We got these results, but and that was a method, I mean, this generalization was brutal, and we knew it cannot be reliable for all temperatures. If at all, then at low temperatures. But these guys then took the data and realized, well, for their case, it just needs flat dependence on temperature. And so they were rather happy, and we were happy, and then we published, but only in 2005. Here are some equations shown that underlie the calculations in the right plot. But that's not the end of the story. First of all, the results shown here at high temperatures are certainly wrong. Therefore, a couple of people did conformal field theory calculations, in particular Jesko Zirke, and here in blue are shown the, let's say, analytical beta-ansatz-like results for delta equals 0.1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and here for 1. And in blue is shown the CFT data. I don't want to comment too much, but in a sense we could say, well, this is a confirmation. But on the other hand, there are certain assumptions going on in CFT. A certain operator in the perturbation has been dropped, and if it is kept, then there's no derivative at all. Anyway, there are real-time dynamics calculated by TMRG, and they suggest that the derivative is zero for the XXZ chain, except for the free fermion point. I'm always talking about magnetic field equal to zero. But then there are very, very recent numerics that tell another story, and so what might be the problem? When doing the calculations, TBL-like equations, or calculation of the curvatures from beta ansatz, the proper treatment of the strings is essential. Here is shown a bunch of data. These are the spin stiffnesses for a certain temperature for different microstates and versus system size. And here, these states were treated properly, and in color are shown results where the strings were modeled like ideal strings, and you see the results deviate a lot. So the rigid string picture underlying TBA is maybe one source of problems. Here, I like to flash some equations. This is a Y system for the row-to-row transfer matrices of the finite size Heisenberg chain with excitations of string type. Here, all of these parameters, which usually appear as string positions, also appear, but these are the only parameters that appear, and these are just real parameters. And then we don't have to worry about the string composition when dealing with this Y system. So I expect that along this line we will be able to calculate the Drude weight at finite temperature, but it's an open problem right now. Next and most exciting and the last topic for today. It's about correlation functions, equal time correlators of, well, let us take here the isotopic spin 1/2 Heisenberg chain, but many things I'm going to show apply to the anisotropic generalization and also with magnetic field and so on. In 1938 and in 1977, exact results came about for the nearest neighbor and the next nearest neighbor correlators. The nearest neighbor correlator is given by the ground state energy that was calculated by Hultin. And the next nearest neighbor correlator can be obtained from a strong coupling expansion of the ground state energy of the Hubbard model. That was done by Takahashi in 77. And then later, maybe in 2001 and 2, results for the third nearest neighbor correlator were obtained. These results are based on excellent work by Jinmu, Miki, Miwa, Nakayashiki, by use of the vertex operator approach and by use of the Kniezhnik-Zamolodchikov equation. This leads to multiple integral expressions for correlation function and for the entries of the density matrix. The multiple integrals are a problem by themselves, and it took a while, and it took Bose and Kurepin to figure out how to calculate these integrals. Let me show to you more results and let us do some observations. The first observation should be a positive observation. The analytical results, show that these calculations are feasible. Well, a more depressing observation is the farther you go out with the correlators, or the longer the separation is, the smaller the numerical result, the smaller the numerical value, but the analytical expressions grow even faster. So here's the fourth nearest neighbor correlator given by two lines. I forgot to say, zeta is a Riemann zeta function, and always arguments appear which are odd integers. For the fifth nearest neighbor, there are seven lines. And for the sixth nearest neighbor, there are 18 lines, which is one page, one A4 page. And the seventh nearest neighbor is that fills three pages. So roughly, we could say there is an exponential increase with a factor of three. So if you plot it, I think roughly it comes out. So that's not so nice. Also, not very nice is the following observation. I mean, why could one be interested in writing down these exact results? Maybe because there are hidden algebraic relations, maybe recursion relations. I mean, for separation n, there is a relation of the correlation function to separation n minus 1, or things like that. Unfortunately, all of these Riemann zeta function values for odd integers are algebraically disconnected. They are not related to each other. So there are no algebraic relations for two-point functions for different separation. And also, there are no algebraic Wick theorem-like relations. For instance, relating four side 0, 1, 2, 3, correlators to two-point correlators. So if you look at these expressions, you look at that, and then, well, there are no algebraic relations. Too bad. Another example of correlators, well, there will be good observation in a minute. But let me introduce to you some correlators which have attracted interest because of theoretical reasons. The so-called emptiness formation probability. It's the expectation value of an operator which is 1 if all the spins point into plus 1/2 direction, it's 0 in all other cases. This expectation value is actually identical to the element, the first element of the density matrix with row and column index plus 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 plus. And for this correlator, there are explicit results in the infinite volume limit and zero temperature given here by 1/2, 1/3, minus 1/3 times log 2, and so on, and then there are the Riemann zeta functions. Now, this looks like before, but if we take these quantities and we evaluate them on an inhomogeneous lattice, thank you, on an inhomogeneous lattice where we somehow attach to site number 1 some spectral parameter lambda 1, to site 2 a spectral parameter lambda 2, and so on, then we get these results. The emptiness formation probability for one for a segment consisting of one spin is still 1/2. So that's due to the symmetry in spin space. For P2, we get 1/4. So for independent spins, the emptiness formation probability would be 1/4. But then there is an additional contribution. And independence of, in the presence of lambda 1 and lambda 2, it's a function of lambda 1 and lambda 2. P3 is given by some number, plus some rational expression in the lambdas times Well, the same omega with two arguments, not with three arguments, not with lambda 1, 2, 3, but with lambda 1 and lambda 2. And then there are two permutations, I mean two similar terms where lambda 1 and 2 are replaced by lambda 1, lambda 3, and lambda 2, lambda 3. And P4 again, well, everything that appears here is algebraic in the lambdas, and then there come terms which are linear in the omegas and bilinear in the omegas. So I would say this has some clear algebraic structure. What is the inhomogeneity lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3? So we are dealing with expectation values or of quantum spin chains, and that can be mapped to classical systems. Here is shown, let's say, the classical counterpart to the Heisenberg spin chain with zero temperature. We are dealing with the infinite volume limit, so the horizontal direction is unbounded, and in vertical direction we are dealing with the imaginary time direction, and each of these rows corresponds to an exponential of the Hamiltonian times, a time slice, and the number of time imaginary time slices goes to infinity. So that models zero temperature. And, lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3, and 4, in the case of four sides, are just placed on the vertical lines. On all other vertical lines, we have spectral parameter zero. And the omega function for zero temperature and zero magnetic field is just given by the series, and it's a digamma function. So various questions arise when looking at these expressions. First of all, how do these expressions appear? They appear if you are brave enough, if you take the multiple integral expressions and then you beat on these expressions, or you can take these expressions and check that certain functional equations are satisfied, namely the Knižnik-Zomolodchikov-like equations. The next set of questions is the limit lambda 1, 2, 3, 4 to 0 singular? In the end, we want to remove the lambdas. They have to be sent to 0. And here, I've completely forgot to tell you, lambda 1, 3, for instance, is lambda 1 minus lambda 3. So all of these terms in the denominator go to 0. So this is highly singular. Is it really singular? Well, algebraically, yes. I mean, if you don't know anything about the omegas, forget about it. But analytically, well, omegas depend analytically on lambda 1, lambda 2, and then you can apply de L'Hopital's rule and so on. So everything is fine. Nothing is wrong about it. But in that limit, the omegas disappear partially, and omega primes, double prime, and so on appear. Well, why should we care about these expressions? We care because we can prove that the same expressions hold for arbitrary temperature. And for arbitrary temperature, we even manage to calculate this omega function. Omega is given here in terms of an integral involving some function g. The function g has to satisfy a linear integral equation given here. Some function a appears here as well as there. And the function a satisfies the this truncated set of nonlinear integral equations of type 2. Here's shown the result based on this reasoning. This is the temperature dependence of two-point correlators for nearest neighbors, next nearest neighbor, and so on. So nearest neighbor is given by red, next nearest neighbor by black. And, what is the variable on the horizontal axis? That's the reciprocal temperature. So infinite temperature is at zero. Positive values correspond to positive temperatures and the interferromagnetic chain. Negative values correspond to positive temperatures for the ferromagnetic chain. Here I show the results for the entanglement entropy of the interferromagnetic chain at low temperatures. The entanglement entropy as a function of the chain or length of the segment grows logarithmically as it should, and at high temperature it grows linearly. Okay, here's a walk of fame of people who contributed a lot. I would like to focus in the last minute on these sets of authors. The proof of the factorization in the most general case was done in 2009 by algebraic means by Jim Umiwa and Smirnov. And recently we managed to get a much simplified algebraic analytic proof. How does this work? We look again at the cylinder, semi-infinite. In the horizontal direction, we have infinitely many sides, and we have a finite number of rows. And for the most general case we can think of, we allow for an arbitrary number of these rows, which we call the total number n, and we place arbitrary spectral parameters u1, 2, 3, 4, and so on the horizontal lines. And then we can easily prove that the entries of the density matrix as functions of the lambda 1, 2, and so on objects, these entries are meromorphic. The numerator is in general unknown, but the denominator is just the product of the largest eigenvalues of this vertical or the column-to-column transfer matrix evaluated at little lambda 1, 2, and 3, and so on. What is the functional equation I was alluding to? Well, it reads explicitly like this. The density matrix for n successive sites is independence on lambda 1, lambda 2, to lambda n minus 1, and then lambda n, the last object, is replaced by lambda n minus 1. That can be written in linear combinations by the entries of the density matrix with unmodified arguments. This equation holds for zero temperature for all complex lambdas. For finite temperature, or let's say for the finite total number, it's still okay to have arbitrary complex lambda 1, 2, up to lambda n minus 1, but the lambda n has to be taken from the set of parameters that appear as spectral parameters on the horizontal lines. Well, and here's some inconsistency. These Vs should be used. Anyway, and using these functional equations, discrete functional equations, the analyticity condition, we can prove that is a unique solution. And also, let me skip this. Let me go to this. This is a result for the mirror model. So before I was talking about infinite volume, finite temperature, we have these results. The same equations apply to the finite size systems. So we change from model to mirror model. Here are the equations. The only change is that in the equation for little a, instead of beta times energy, there is L times momentum. And these are the results for the finite size correlators. And this is a summary of my talk. The open problems is the spin Drude weight at finite temperature, and then an efficient calculation of these factorized formulas for spin 1/2, and even more so for finite for spins larger than 1/2, spin 1, and so on. So this is the last I wanted to show to you. Thank you very much for your interest and your patience.
Thank you, Andreas. Please, some questions.
How much is known about the story for higher rank case other than SL2?
The higher rank. So what we did in the past is we did these studies for SL3, SL4, and SL5. SL3, I think we did in the 90s, SL4 and SL5, we did only a few years ago. The trouble from our point of view was, well, we always made ansatz for these auxiliary functions. And then we found out for SL3, we need 6 functions. Yeah? So it's the sum of dimensions of the fundamental representations of SL3. And the same holds true for SL4. So I think then the number is 10. And you see by pedestrian approach, it's difficult to continue. And that's why I said I expect that something like algebraic means, like the Beckmann transformation and the recent work by the people I showed, mentioned at least in writing, that can be generalized. But still, if my expectation should be right, that number of minimal functions is still exponentially growing as a function of rank. So in a sense, anyway, I answered your question about the historical thing. So we actually evaluated specific heats and susceptibilities, also for the graded cases, SL2/2 and things like that, the Esler-Korotkin-Skoutens model. So that has been done. So for the models that are of imminent interest to condensed matter physics, it has been done. I cannot really comment on what is necessary for ADS-CFT. Systematically something is missing anyhow.
I thought the rank, the number of independent functions should grow as a rank, more or less.
At least in all our examples, it's like that. Yeah. This is, so to say, formulation number zero. I know about a formulation where the number of unknown functions grows linearly with the rank. I mean, then you do the following. You take the Betansatz equations, you declare the objects that appear as your auxiliary function, and then you take a contour around the roots. That works. It's certainly correct, but when going to these systems I only mentioned, and you introduce finite temperature, finite chemical potential, finite magnetic field, and then you want to do calculations, then you discover that you have to use contours that have to curve and bend in a complex plane. You cannot stick to a straight contour because singularities will cross. And that's the end of your calculation. So those equations are not so good. They exist, but they are not good for applications.
More questions, please?
So in quantum transfer matrix approach, the largest eigenvalue is related to free energy, right? And
yeah.
What is the physical meaning of next largest eigenvalues?
The next largest eigenvalue is usually the correlation length of, or the set of next largest ones, depending on the quantum numbers you choose. And then this describes the exponential decay of these correlators. So it gives you the correlation length of the spin-spin correlators or of the energy-energy correlators. And we also investigated that at low temperatures, and there are conformal field theory predictions for that. And it just agrees, yeah. So you at low temperatures for the critical systems, these correlation lenses increase like 1 over T. And the prefactor contains a scaling dimension and so on. Yeah. So it depends on which object you are interested in, and then you get the correlation length, the finite correlation length at finite temperature.
Well, I have a small question on the thermodynamic bed on the third one. I mean the single T function. I'd like to know where you can extract the information of excited states also in that case by the contour deformation.
Yeah. That is actually... You name the problem. From memory, this is good for all eigenvalues. Mm-hmm. And it is used for the largest eigenvalue by writing down a high-temperature Cs expansion. The high-temperature Cs expansion starts with a non-zero term. For the excited states, it should start with a zero, and then I think the analysis becomes, sticky, difficult, maybe even impossible. I personally did not think so much about it. I know it is probably valid for all eigenvalues, but it can be used practically only for the largest eigenvalue. Zengotzuber should know more. I'm not sure where he is.
Okay. Maybe almost the last question.
Do you think that any excited state can be obtained by deforming a contour?
Yes, I think that's true, yeah. Mm-hmm. But I should prove it somehow, yeah.
So there is no proof for any model of this statement?
From memories, when I was actively working on that, I just had the impression it is so, yeah. So what you do is, so how does it work? I mean, when dealing with the excited states, you have functional equations, and you want to solve them or write them in terms of integral equations. And then in the ground state, let's say the analytical properties are simple. Yeah, so usually there are certain strips free of zeros. Singularities usually do not occur. And then for the excited states, there are zeros, additional zeros. And then you have to worry about those. And then I think the observation was, if you take the contours that used to be straight and just avoid the new objects, you can do it in a consistent manner. So you worry about the consistency because there are several sets of equations and you don't want to introduce for different equations different contours, because then you have to work with the same function on different contours. That would mean inconsistency. But I had the impression that consistency is guaranteed by intrinsically. But, well, it's not such a proof. Anyway, I told you we did case studies, and in the case studies it's just true. The case studies referred to the rank, but then it was rather systematic, I think.
I will abuse my position to ask by asking the last question.
I don't object.
You showed very exciting experiments, which justify, which somehow can be explained by integrability of Heisenberg chain. Could you imagine a regime of Heisenberg spin chain when you feel the anti-ferromagnetic vacuum, where you can reach the experimentally, I mean, on these materials, when you can reach this sigma model regime with relativistic particles, etc. Is it possible such an experiment?
So, I think that is the low temperature regime, and it's the regime of Alex Zwelling. I think, the relativistic regime of the spin 1/2 Heisenberg chain is a low temperature regime.
Can you reach it by real experiments on the materials?
Yes. Really? Well, there are plenty of experiments, but you have to take into account that real materials are not completely one-dimensional.
Yes.
And therefore, for low temperatures, there are deviations, which can also be explained, even quantitatively explained by the theory, if you take into account interactions between these chains. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Maybe we have to stop here.